This is the first day of this April 2008 7-day session. This is the the last 7-day session in this first year of sitting in the new Zendo. For these first few days, I'll be reading from the talks of Japanese Zen master Basui. And I'll be reading from a book called Mud and Water. And this is translated by Arthur Braverman. This was this is the only known book of his talks. He didn't ask that this be compiled, but he gave permission that it be done. I'll just start right in with his biography. He was born in 1327 in Japan, of course. He's born at a time when the Hojo, a military family that ruled over Japan for more than 100 years, was losing its control over the country. And Japan was on the verge of a civil war that would last more than 50 years. Basui's mother was said to have had a dream that she would give birth to a demon child. This disturbed her so much that we're told that she abandoned the newborn Basui in a nearby field. A family servant found the child there, took him in, and raised him. A footnote tells us that he may have been left with the understanding that the servant would pick him up. So it's not unlikely that he would have been abandoned only in a formal sense in order to fend off the evil spirits. This sounds very Japanese, that there would be a little discussion between the mother and the servant that she would leave the baby in such and such a place and thereby breaking the spell or whatever, I don't know. But when he was just 4 years old, his father died. He's not off to a good start, it would seem. And then 3 years later, when he was seven, there was a memorial service for his father. And at the service, Basui asked the officiating priest how his father could eat the offerings placed on the altar. He was told that it was his father's soul that would eat the offerings. Not a good reply. Bzzzt. Maybe for a child, maybe it's okay. And then he asked, what is this thing called a soul? And that started a years of inquiry by Basui, actually an inquiry that was he was to pursue throughout most of his life. What is this thing called a soul? Or we could say a self. When he was about 9 years old, that was 2 years later, he became horrified when he heard a talk of the agonies of the three evil paths. The three evil paths are referred to the three lowest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. So they are the realm of hell, the realm of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, and the realm of animals. They're called the three evil paths because they are the effect. Being born into any of these three realms is the effect of having sown some very painful karma. And then he inquired more deeply into the meaning of soul. And then this led him to investigate another question: who is the one who sees, hears, and understands? We're told that for long periods of time he sat in zazen, forgetting his own body, until one day he realized there was nothing one could grasp to call the soul. We could call this a first experience of emptiness. With this new view of the emptiness of all things, Basui no longer felt the burden of body and mind, and his doubts about the Buddha Dharma, for the time being, were cleared up. Well, this was all fine until one day he read in a popular book, "The mind is host, the body is guest." This is an old way in Asia that they would distinguish between body and mind, where we go through different bodies in our various births, lifetimes, but the mind is host. It's definitely a flawed way of understanding and not really a Buddhistic way because of the dualistic formulation of it. And so after reading this, mind is host, the body is guest, again, doubts began to arise in him. And he thought, if the mind is host, then all cannot be empty. This host must be the master who sees, hears, and understands that all things are empty. But who then is this master? He couldn't free himself of this new doubt. When he was 20, he went to practice under Zen master Oko in his home province. He didn't shave his head and become a monk, however, until he was 29. When he did at last officially become a monk, he had little taste for ritual and rejected the superstitions that clothed so many of the religious institutions of his time. He didn't wear robes and he didn't recite sutras like the other monks. Recite sutras really means chanting. It's what we do twice a day in Sesshin. He simply practiced meditation in an uncompromising fashion. He was oblivious to wind, rain, and cold. And this was his style of practice throughout his life. So we jumped, we made a couple big jumps here in this biography. From the age of 9 to suddenly we're at 20, and then from 20 we're at 29 when he became ordained as a monk. That's all we have on Basui. There was a monk from Basui's hometown by the name of Tokuke Jisha, who had cut himself off from the world, retired to the mountains, and had been practicing religious austerities for many years. Basui heard of this monk, and he decided to pay him a visit. When Tokuke saw Basui with his head shaved but in layman's clothes, he asked him, "Why don't you wear monk's robes?" And here we have this little dialogue. Basui replied, "I became a monk to understand the great matter of life and death, not to wear Buddhist robes." Tokuke said, I see. Then are you looking into the koans of the old masters? Basui, of course not. How can I appreciate the words of others when I don't even know my own mind? And we'll hear later that he felt that one should not work on koans until having had kensho. Then Tokuke said, well then, how do you approach your practice? And Basui said, having become a monk, I want to clarify the source of the great Dharma handed down by the Buddhas and the ancestors. After attaining enlightenment, I want to save the bright and the dull, teaching each one according to his capacity. My true desire is to relieve others of their pain, even though I myself may fall into hell. And then when Tokuke heard this, he put his palms together and bowed. And from then on, they developed a friendship that became deeper as over time. So even there, this is, he's freshly ordained, he hasn't yet had any real enlightenment experience. Even there, notice his aspiration. My true desire is to relieve others of their pain. It's a wonderful blessing to have this foremost in one's mind. Not how can I get out of this pain, my own confusion and distress, but how can I help others? And that would be an early indication of resources as a kind of a bodhisattva. He vowed not to teach a word of the Dharma to others until he received certification of his own realization from a true teacher. And once he received such certification, he would devote his life to helping others. To fulfill this vow, he practiced harder than ever, telling himself, this doubting mind is, after all, empty. He carried this investigation as far as he could without any real clarification. Then one day, after sitting in zazen through the night, the sound of the mountain stream at dawn penetrated his whole body, and Basui suddenly had a realization. Just to pick up a couple of points here, he would tell himself that even his own questioning mind is empty. He was able to do this not because he'd read it somewhere, but because he'd had that experience of emptiness. He could remind himself out of his own experience. And notice here, with this realization, this came after sitting through the night. And then he went in search of a teacher to verify his understanding. He heard of a well-known Zen master by the name of Kozan and Kamakura, and he went off to see him, and Kozan confirmed Basui's understanding. Basui was 31 years old at the time. And then, this is very interesting, this was the time that he started wearing the Buddhist robes and began making pilgrimages around the country visiting Zen masters. So after really seeing the emptiness of form, then he could relax and accept the wisdom of wearing robes if you're ordained. He went to see yet another master by the name of Fukuan. He was quite famous. He had studied in China. This Japanese master had studied in China, and he had a following that numbered about 2,000. But Basui was unimpressed with him and returned to his hometown and went to see his friend Tokuke. He told Tokuke, by the way, Tokuke is, it sounds like from elsewhere here in this biography, Tokuke was quite a bit older than Basui. He told Tokuke that he had not got on well with Fukuan and was planning to practice by himself in some isolated mountain retreat. Now remember, Tokuke had spent over 20 years practicing in seclusion and had developed a great deal of pride in his practice. And this pride became the cause of much of his pain and suffering. This is always the backside of those who are endowed with strong willpower, is that they become arrogant about how much more willpower and self-discipline they have than other people. Apparently, he recognized this, but recognizing it isn't the same as dissolving it. So he noticed this, apparently. He noticed this in himself, this pride, but he couldn't shake it. And he warned Basui of the dangers of this kind of seclusion before fully understanding the great matter or receiving the transmission from a true teacher. Well, he had received approval from this master Kozan. He took Tokuke's advice and gave up the idea of going into seclusion in the mountains. And instead, he spent that year in a summer and winter training session with Tokuke. Tokuke told Basui of a certain Koho, another master, who was considered a truly great teacher. And Basui then set off to see Koho. This Master Koho was a Dharma grandson of Mumon, the master who compiled the Mumonkan. He was a strict teacher who greatly valued the precepts. There aren't many of those around these days. But and he did not confirm Basui's understanding right away. Instead, he asked him to stay a while at his temple. Basui did stay, but as was his custom, he declined to stay on the temple grounds. He lived in a nearby hut and visited the master every day for Doksan. One day, during Doksan, Koho asked Basui why Joshu responded mu when he was asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? And he just gave this one word, mu. And Basui answered with this verse, mountains, rivers, and the great earth, grass, trees, and the forests are all mu. But Koho scolded him for responding with his rational mind. And as he did so, Basui felt as though the foundation of his body and mind fell off like the bottom falling off a barrel. He expressed his experience in this poem. Six windows naturally open. This is referring to the six senses. Six windows naturally open, a cold, lone flower. Koho strikes the rubbish from my eyes, crushes the gem in my hand right before me. So be it. This gold has become iron. And this Koho verified as true enlightenment and gave him the name that we're using, Basui, which means far above average. And Basui was 32 years old. And this profound awakening of Basui's pointed out to him how narrow his previous view of emptiness was. And he spent only 2 months more there at the temple, and again he hit the road, seeking out Zen masters to engage in Dharma talk. He was asked to stay on to receive the Bodhisattva precepts. It's Jukai. But he had little fondness for the ceremony connected with temples, and he decided to move on. His desire to seclude himself in a mountain retreat in order to deepen his understanding remained alive. So we can see already that this man was a real maverick. He did things his own way. He was very much an individualist. And then Basui built his first hermitage. His friend Tokuke, came to visit him there, and this time he seemed pleased with Basui's decision to retire to a hermitage to continue his practice. And he seemed to indicate to Basui that having clarified the way and having received verification from a true teacher, he was ready to undertake this kind of secluded practice. And Basui had a dream that his old teacher, Koho, was near death. So he went to him and found that, yes, he was in bad condition. And he wanted to stay with him. And then it says here, he left, however, for reasons uncertain, but perhaps related to strained relations with some long-standing disciples of the teacher. And then the translator here, this is all from the translator, Arthur Braverman's introduction, speculates. He says the older disciples may have resented Basui's decision to live off the temple grounds when he first studied under Koho, or maybe some were jealous that Basui had received transmission from Koho after such a short stay with him. And all of this resentment may have been compounded by the fact that Basui did not mix with the other monks and refused to take part in the temple activities during his short stay there. These are all, I think, very plausible explanations for why Basui may not have felt welcome to stay there with Koho's senior disciples. He hadn't done the time there. You see that Zen masters had their own styles, they were individuals, and they didn't all beat to the same drum. And then Koho did die at the age of 91, same as Roshi Kapo. And at that time, Basui was 35. In Japan, there is enormous pressure to go along with the group, to conform to what everyone else is doing. There's this famous saying, some of you know it, in Japan, that the nail that sticks up gets pounded down. And Basui sounds like Basui was that nail sticking up. And then Basui moved to another hermitage. And he met another master who he really respected. They talked about the meaning of monastic life and of Basui's practice before his formal ordination. Basui spoke to the monks at that temple. He told them that the meaning of monkhood was not to recite sutras, but rather to put their lives in order. That's a great phrase, isn't it? We can say, too, that we practice and we come to Sesshin to put our lives in order. Find our natural order, to find our own way, to clarify our lives, our experience of our lives, clarify our relationships, our work. This is all what he means, to put one's life in order. Basui always warned against the danger of excessive formalization that is so common in the great religious institutions of the time. He himself preferred small hermitages over large monasteries. Then Basui spent the next 17 years moving around the country, living in many hermitages. Though he never stayed more than 3 years in any one place, a following of monks began to grow around him. When the numbers got to be too great, he even went so far as to leave a hermitage secretly and relocate somewhere else. And it wasn't until his final years of his life that he seemed ready to accept disciples in large numbers. So we can conclude from this that Basui, even though he had had a profound enlightenment experience, still felt the need to refine it, to see more deeply into his nature, and to work out what may have been the rough edges of his personality, the sharp corners, and to integrate his realization into his everyday life. This is the hard part. I mean, the awakening itself is hard enough, but it's after awakening that we have to bring that insight, the wisdom that we have realized, to bring our lives in line with that, to be able to live in accord with what we know to be true. This is a lifelong practice to do it perfectly, or maybe lifetimes, before we can fully and completely integrate our understanding into our daily lives. This also means into our emotional lives. There can be wisdom, the wisdom that comes from enlightenment, but then there is a lag where one still can get angry, one can still fall prey to this blind passion or that blind passion, at least momentarily. Doesn't mean one has to, one spirals into dark paths that create pain for oneself and for others, but one still notices that there is a pattern of reacting to people and to situations that doesn't just go away even after deep enlightenment. And that's the work then, is to purify one's responses so that one can live up to what one has seen. In 1378, when he was 51 years old, Basui moved to another hermitage, and the number of disciples kept increasing. The records show that 800 students gathered there. It says, because of the steep mountain path and the strong winds, Basui was encouraged to move to a famous hermitage, Kogakuan, where he stayed the rest of his life. At this point, it's clear that Basui was ready to accept the role of the teacher of a large institution. He's 53 now. Though he refused the abbotship of two large monasteries, and he kept the final character on, A-N, at the end of his temple, Kogakuan. The An means it's a hermitage rather than a monastery. He accepted all who came to practice under him, and the number grew to over 1,000 monks and lay people. And it was here at this Kogakuan that this mud and water that we're reading from was recorded. It was published a year before Basui's death, not at his request, but with his permission. It's interesting to note that Basui never wrote a book himself. In his final years, he developed great faith in the Bodhisattva Canon. In this book, Mud and Water, he refers to Canon as described in the Sharangama Sutra. He was a person who, for every sound he heard, contemplated the mind of the hearer, realizing his own nature. Notice the male pronouns here. It's originally, Avalokiteshvara, or Kanon, was understood as a man. And then later became a female. We don't have to be concerned with the gender of Kanon. Kanon is our own compassionate nature, our own responsiveness to those who are suffering. The Kanon is said to have come to his great enlightenment through hearing. Elsewhere, I think I've read that it's just not questioning, but just the hearing itself, pure hearing, unmediated by thought. But Basui interpreted this as in this way, that for every sound he heard, he questioned the mind of the hearer. Who is it that hears? In 1387, Basui sat erect in Zazen posture, turned to his disciples, and said, "Look directly. What is this? Look in this manner and you won't be fooled. He repeated this in a loud voice and died. He was 61 years old. Then the translator presents some more information about Basui that I think is worth mentioning. Basui was very critical of the type of monk who was not an uncommon sight at some of the temples he visited. This was the monk who disregarded the correct behavior befitting a monk and acted in an eccentric manner, thinking he was behaving in the spirit of the ancient masters. Such a monk might get drunk, act rudely, break the precepts, and think that his unconventional behavior was proof of his freedom from the shackles created by formal practice. Many of these monks may have gotten their ideas to act this way from reading the koans and the anecdotes of the old masters of the Tang Dynasty. And it says here that it was probably his contact with these monks that made Basui so cautious in his approach to koan training. He warned his disciples about studying the sayings of the old masters before seeing into their own nature. He did, however, say that it was necessary to understand these koans once the student did see into his own nature. To guard against blatant disregard for the monastic regulations, Basui left 33 rules of behavior for the monks at Kogakuan as part of his dying instructions. And the first of these rules forbids the drinking of alcohol. It reads as follows: not a drop of alcohol is to be brought into this temple. Even though it may be said to be for medicinal purposes, no alcohol of any kind should be consumed. Monks from other temples should not drink any alcohol as long as they stay at this temple. Basui was quite firm in his condemnation of the drinking of alcohol. He was once asked, in response to a question about the importance of keeping the precepts, and he said, "The drinking of alcohol, of all broken precepts, is the most upsetting to the serenity of the mind." And then he quoted from a sutra that said, "One who hands another a glass of alcohol, making him drink it, will be born without hands in his next 500 births. How much more so will one who drinks on his own?" He was strict about keeping precepts outwardly, not just strict about keeping them literally. And he went so far as to have a shrine built at Kogakuan with a deity called Bashugami, the god of retribution for drinking alcohol. Well, there's a backstory to this. Some of you may know that the Japanese lack an enzyme that allows them to metabolize alcohol the way many people, Japanese and Native Americans, lack this enzyme, and they very easily get drunk. And we all know that once you're drunk, then there's no limit to the number of other precepts you can break. So he saw this as sort of the Maginot line of the precepts, I think. you know, it was alcohol in his day. Today, I'm sure he would say alcohol and drugs. And so we have our fifth precept, not to cause others to abuse alcohol or drugs, nor to do so oneself, but to keep the mind clear. When I was in Japan many years ago, I heard many stories of monks drinking, going over the wall to go off into the taverns in town and drink and then come back. He found sprawled out in the bathrooms of the monastery, throwing up. And there's this where he says, even though it may be said to be for medicinal purposes, this is probably one of the little rationalizations that is so common in the Japanese temples, where there's probably some loophole they found where, okay, if you take a little alcohol for, you know, a sip for medicinal purposes, then it's okay. They do this for the third meal of the day. It's called the sutras, at least the Indian sutras say that you should not eat after noon. And today, I think it's just the Theravada monks who are sticklers about that, who really do follow that rule. They don't eat after noon. They eat enough in those two meals of the morning to, as much probably as any of us do in our three meals, but they don't eat after noon. But there's some clause in some sutra that you could do so for medicinal purposes. So the Japanese, for the third meal, our third meal when I was at the temples in Japan, the third meal was called yakuseki, which means medicine food or medicine meal. And it's basically the same as the other two meals. Says here that he did allow practices designed for people whose understanding of the way is still quite undeveloped. One such practice was the copying of sutras in this mud and water. He defends this practice by saying that it is a way of emptying the mind. And now just a word about the title of this book that we'll be reading now from starting tomorrow. He said he didn't know what title to give words put together in such a coarse fashion, like mud and water mixed together. And from this conversation, the monk who recorded this and made it into a text decided to call it Mud and Water from Enzan. Enzan, I don't know, it's one of his other names. And that's all we have today. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.